Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and authors who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. Our sponsor for the first season is Park Road Books, the oldest and only full-service independent bookstore in Charlotte. They're located in Park Road Shopping Center. They've got a great staff and an awesome collection of books. And if they don't have something in stock that you want, they can order it for you and have it there quickly. And please check out our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. You can get information about the show and about our guest authors. We'd love to have you become a regular listener. You can listen on iTunes or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And on our website, you can sign up for our email list. We promise not to spam you, just give you updates from time to time about the show. And if you do join, as a thank you, we'll give you a free ebook, the first in a trilogy written by your host. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. Today, we will hear readings from Molly Barker, Charlotte native and founder of Girls on the Run, and later, The Red Boot Way, a program that teaches people an intentional form of communication where self-awareness, trust, and connections happen. Molly will be reading stories from her third book, The Wisdom Stories, a collection of essays about the interesting people she's met over the course of her life. We start first with a story at a restaurant in El Paso, Texas, just across the border from Juarez, Mexico, where life couldn't be more different.
Gladys. As I say elsewhere in these stories, in 2014, after a year and a half of working on Capitol Hill, I set off on a cross-country trip. With no specific itinerary, I drove from town to town, listening to Americans share from their own perspectives what was causing the highly polarized state of our nation. I was 3 weeks into the trip when I started talking with Gladys, the hostess at a restaurant in El Paso, Texas. Gladys pointed across the interstate. That's Juarez, Mexico, one of the most dangerous cities in all of Mexico. Violence there is so frequent it's become commonplace, especially for women. You would be taking your life into your hands if you simply walked across the road and across the border. You will see the border police pacing along the Rio Grande. It's very surreal. I later asked one of my Texas friends to explain how this can be. El Paso is one of the safest cities in the United States, he explained. The cartel that has so corrupted the government, police, and security in Mexico wants no attention drawn to them, so they keep their illegal activity to just across the border. I tried to see across the river, but it was too dark. Gladys spoke Spanish. She grew up in El Paso, went to college, and returned. She was very friendly. I asked her what she thought about the people living in Mexico who are dropping their children on the American side of the border between the two countries. I understand why, she said. You will see Juarez in the morning when you head east on Interstate 10. I'm not a mother yet, but if I were a mom, I wouldn't know what else to do either. Joseph, my waiter, sat down at the table and joined in. We are a culture who bonds through polarization. It's not just politics, it's everywhere, it's in everything. The whole idea of divide and conquer, it's how we think, it's how we are trained. What can we do about it, I asked him. What we are doing right here, talking to each other and sharing our stories, this is what we can do about it. The next morning I headed east on the interstate. Just like Gladys told me, I saw the Border Patrol officer first. He was walking along the banks of the Rio Grande. Looking down into the river itself, I saw a fence there. Juarez is close enough that I could see it in detail. Shanties and shacks constructed out of what looked like cement blocks were crumbling down the mountainside. The roads were so poorly engineered that I wasn't sure cars could use them. I didn't see any cars, people, or life. There were bikes leaning up against cement walls and clothes hanging from clotheslines. They blew in the hot wind. I glanced back to the interstate ahead of me. The billboards, there were dozens of them, called to me. Gucci, Subway, Starbucks, Boots, Comfort Inn, Pandora.
Author Molly Barker is many things. Mother of two children, Ironman triathlete, avid cyclist, social entrepreneur. She founded Girls on the Run, a globally recognized method and model for positive change. She's also founded the Red Bootway, a program that focuses on better communication skills. And she's the author of the Wisdom Stories, which we'll be listening to today. Molly, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you mentioned in this piece, Gladys, at the beginning of the piece, that you spent a year and a half on Capitol Hill before setting off on this cross-country trip. Tell me how you got to Capitol Hill.
It was a strange trip. I was invited to serve on the Commission for Political Reform, which was a think tank from the Bipartisan Policy Center, to explore ways we could address the highly polarized state of the Capitol, of Capitol Hill, and worked on that for about a year and a half. And clearly, not a whole lot was taken into account or accomplished from that.
Was that a good experience for you?
It was an amazing experience. I was an outsider. There were about 29 people on the commission, and there were four or five of us that were not, you know, we didn't work on Capitol Hill. So I got a insider's view and often felt like the fly in the ointment because I was, you know, not afraid to ask some questions that I'm not sure people had ever asked themselves.
And then you took off across country. Was that because you spent so much time in Washington?
I left so disheartened, actually, and really, really disturbed by the mean-spiritedness that I saw there, the jockeying for position. So went off seeking hope, I guess, you know, and interviewed dozens, hundreds of people across America about what they believed was at the root of all this polarization, and came back with hope and joy and a renewed belief in mankind, actually.
So when you were in Washington, you found that people weren't talking to each other, but they were talking at each other?
I would say they weren't even talking to each other. What I had experienced on the trip was people talking with each other, okay, which made it an experience where both parties were being heard.
So you take this cross-country trip. Did you have any idea where you were going or where you were going to end up or what was going to happen?
I had a little bit of an idea. So thanks to Girls on the Run, I have a social media platform that allowed me to sort of toss this out into the universe. And about 12 different people said, hey, come to my home. We'll host a group. And that was everywhere from Williamsport, Pennsylvania to Denver, Colorado, all the way down to Birmingham. So we would have gatherings of 10 to 30 people. Also, it was in the random meetings where a lot of the really juicy conversations happened, you know, in a coffee shop or Starbucks at a truck stop, places like that, where my eyes were really opened.
Do you think you found out anything on this journey that you could now take back to Washington that might be effective?
That is a great question. So I'm still in a position of inquiry at the moment. I almost feel like there needs to be a third way or a new emerging tactic, if that's not the right word, that supersedes or transcends what's happening on Capitol Hill. It's the way politics is and is so deeply entrenched. I don't know that what I'm advocating for would ever work in politics.
So one of the things you hear, which is, I don't know if it's an excuse or an explanation, but that the representatives in Congress are merely speaking for their constituents, and therefore, to be true to their constituents, they need to speak the language of their constituents. And oftentimes that language coming from all different parts of the United States is so polarizing. And it sounds to me a little bit like this journey you take is where you get away from the larger conversations and break it down to individual conversations. Is that?
Absolutely. And I've written in the book, I think we're going to read one of those stories about those tiny moments of change that occur where just the smallest door is opened and a person wakes up a little bit or becomes more self-aware of a bias they might have had. Those aren't going to occur when people are yelling at each other. They're just not. Now, I'm not suggesting that we don't also need some strong-willed, hard voices to speak up on various things. That's just not what has been my calling. Mine is more these smaller moments of recognition of myself and the other.
And this book, The Wisdom Stories, that you're reading from, that came out of this journey that you took?
It did, in a way. What began to happen, though, was as I reflected on this trip, I began to realize that everything in my life has been influenced by these small little moments. There's a lot in the book about my own upbringing and my children. Oh my gosh, my children have pushed me so far outside of my comfort zone, and they were just in the smallest moments. You know, just walking into the mall, a conversation I had with my son that I was like, wow, he just woke me up a little bit. So it's really about a lot of moments like that.
And your children are grown now?
They're grown. They're 22 and 20.
Okay. And you're a native Charlottean.
I am a native Charlottean.
And this thing, Girls on the Run, which is, as I said in the opening, it's a global organization now. You started that here in Charlotte?
I started that right here in Charlotte.
Now, and did you have any idea that this was going to be as large as it turned out to be?
I knew when I started it. Just like what I'm stressing here, I believe if we all did this, it would change things. But I knew when I started it that impacting one girl and then another girl, and you just grow that circle, that's where change happens. And I believe that I knew in my heart that something big was happening.
And you got this idea of running one day?
Actually, the idea sort of evolved after a run. I had an epiphany while out on a run, and I wrote about this in the book as well, that I've struggled with addiction, alcoholism in particular. And when I got sober, just started to see things that I hadn't seen before around connection. And so started Girls on the Run to give girls some tools I might have missed out on during my youth.
Yeah, I think I described you as a social entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
You've gotten into these different organizations that help support people emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about the Red Boot in a moment. But is that something that, it sounds like you're a person that wants to understand other people.
I don't know if it's, yes, I want to understand people, but I'm also extremely curious. One of my sisters reminded me recently that my first word as a human being was the word see, S-E-E, and I would just point at things and go, see, 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 just with this absolute wonder. And I think that is what has driven me. It's about understanding, but my gosh, people are so fascinating and interesting, especially the ones that I don't understand or agree with.
Now, this piece, Gladys, that you read, it's a very timely story. Immigration is in the news. It will probably be in the news for years. But you're not, this is not a political essay, so to speak. This is you're talking about what's reality on both sides of the border and what one person or two people might think when they look across the border about whether they would do the same thing if they were in the position across the border. Is that the message you were trying to get across?
At the time, I'll need to be really transparent. I did not know that immigration was an issue. I was just recounting a story that this woman and I shared in the El Paso restaurant. It's funny to me as I reflect back on many of these stories how there was no political intent in my sharing them. However, they are now and will be perceived as political, which I think is really fascinating.
Well, you juxtapose the scene of Juarez, Mexico, dilapidated buildings. There's no real infrastructure to speak of. And just across the border, You've got these billboards with Gucci. And it's sort of, were you born on one side of the fence or the other side of the fence, right?
Right.
It sort of evokes this idea of empathy. And that's one of the things you bring into your conversations, right? The topic of empathy.
Yeah, so it was so, I remember the moment that morning, the way the sun was rising as I was driving on Interstate 10, and just having the moment of Gucci sign within a few yards, literally, of a country that in that city was falling apart. And I remember thinking, I'm not sure that Gucci is so great either. In other words, you know, what where does success come from? What is happiness? Is it through a Gucci, you know, handbag? Is it through family? I mean, my mind, that's the sort of struggle this trip provoked within me, because I know it just was very provocative.
There's another story I want to move to here now that's a little bit different take on the same topic. Here you're in Gladys, you're talking about two different places and the contradictions that exist, you know, between the two. In this story that you write, I believe you titled it Dear Trump Supporter, you are actually talking about people's perceptions. In this case, your own perception, which you then come to actually criticize yourself about later in the piece.
Dear Trump Supporter in the baggage claim area. I knew you were a Trump supporter because you had a shirt on that said Trump 2016. You were an overweight white man in your 50s, I'm guessing. You wore a baseball cap backward on your head, a pair of shiny athletic shorts, socks, and a pair of work boots. I saw you earlier on the plane as I passed you. I wrote the story of you in my head on the way to my seat, the story I read every day in the news. White, Southern, probably racist, uneducated, angry, and lower income. I'm not proud of myself for that. We were in baggage claim when I saw you again, but this time you were with your daughter in her wheelchair. She was in her teens, a person with Down syndrome. I watched you get down on one knee and ever so tenderly offer the slice of apple you had pulled from a Disney princess lunchbox. You handed it to her, smiled as she ate it. You handed her another. She smiled again. You offered the water bottle. She drank. You were patient. Oh, so patient. Anything else, honey? You asked. She shook her head. I watched you smile. I watched her smile. And for that moment, I saw you. Damn the media. Damn these stories. Damn it all.
I guess you're trying to focus here on stereotypes and what happens when you buy into them.
Totally. I mean, it's even hard to read that. And this internal dialogue that I had in my mind and still battle with about the other, whoever the other is, you know, where those come from and how they just get so embedded into my psyche.
So this is not a political show where we take sides and we're not, except to the extent that essays cause us to think. Mm-hmm. But this, I think what we're getting at early on is that as you're looking at this person in the baggage claim area and all the paraphernalia they're wearing that leads you to believe that they do support President Trump, that some of the personality flaws that people criticize our president for, one of which is a lack of patience, would be something that this person would have as well, because he's a supporter, potentially, of the president. And yet you see something totally different when you watch a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain that?
You know, I just think, as I learned on that trip, that it just serves some people to separate us from our own humanity. And that experience in the airport, it still chokes me up. You can hear it in my voice. Really has continued to stay with me. And it's difficult sometimes when I'm hearing either side say demeaning things about the other. And I just remember this man and his daughter's smile. And it just, again, provokes and wreaks a little havoc with my ability to stay mean or angry.
Now, back to your experience in Washington for just a minute and what you were observing, and add to this a layer that involves other countries, whether you want to say it's Russia, China, whoever, trying to take over our social media. There are actually stories out there, and I think Facebook has acknowledged, for example, that these other countries, including Russia, are trying to not necessarily create new schisms that exist between our populace, but to take some of the ones that we've had for years and amplify them by focusing on different groups. Maybe they focus on African Americans' distrust of police, or maybe they trust on certain Americans' distrust of immigrants, and they promote false information to try to ramp up the polarization within the community. Now, that's a step beyond just people not talking with each other, and it has a psychological effect. What have you learned through your journey and through this Red Boot Way, which we're going to talk about, that helps could help us deal with something like that?
I have observed a lot of people, especially as of late, getting very protective of their minds by getting more selective about how they use social media. I've noticed in particular, many of my friends of color are kind of hunkering down into creating communities of reality. And I believe I've even found myself doing that lately. I'm starting a workshop that's getting people off social media and engaging like this with each other, because it's toxic and it can be very traumatic, especially to people who've already experienced trauma, to just have this trauma replayed over and over with their social media.
The Red Boot Way. You're wearing sandals today, not your red boots.
Yeah.
But you do have a pair of red boots in your closet.
Several.
Where did the red boots come from?
My daughter gave me those red boots, and I actually write about that in the book as well. I am not a fashion person at all, and both of my children are. And my daughter gave me a pair of red boots for my 50th birthday and said, "Mom, you need to get outside. This stereotype you have of yourself is getting old." So that's what those boots are about.
All right, so you went boot scooting across America in your red boots.
And like I said, now I have several pair. And what happened was, when I was wearing those boots, people were more inclined to come up to me and chat. And there's actually research, I just heard a blog, a podcast about this, that folks who wear red shoes tend to be the conversation starters in rooms. So apparently I was onto something before I knew it.
I've always wondered why I liked red as my favorite color.
There you go.
Okay. So the boots, the Red Boot Way, you've got a number of concepts within this organization that are designed to help people with communication skills, one of which is gratitude and others understanding. And talk a little bit about the Red Boot Way.
So the Red Boot Way is actually a practice, and it's a mindset that I became conscious of after I got back from the trip. I sat down with a good friend of mine named Charlie Elberson and Elaine Miller. She was there. And I just processed the trip. What was happening? And there were various things. I was curious. I had no agenda. I just listened. I assumed positive intent and wrote all those characteristics or principles out, and that is what has become the Red Boot Way.
You start off, I think step one is, I'm essential to myself, my family, my community, I matter. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about step two, being empowered. Step three is transparency. Step four is intentionality. Then you're open, grounded, present, curious, grateful, compassionate, and engaged. 11 steps?
11 steps. Okay. Somebody said, why isn't it 12? And I said, because it's 11.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Could have been 10. But they're not. It's not step one, and then you move to step two. These are a consolidation of ideas. Mm-hmm. And again, did these ideas come to you at once, over time?
They basically came at once in the Brugers over there at Park Road Shopping Center. I mean, that's, you know, they just came out after the trip, and the steps just sort of flowed. We've made some tweaks. Ann Crehor is a good friend of mine who helped simplify them.
So how do these concepts, back to the topic of polarization in America, how do these ideas help us get beyond the need to be right? Maybe that's not the right way to put it, but mm-hmm. a lot of times polarization stems from the fact that people have certain positions and they need to be right about them. Mm-hmm. How do your ideas help us get beyond that?
And let me be clear that I think it's okay to want to be right and to say, I am right, and I'm not going to demean you because I don't agree with you. That is part of, it's like how to hold two seemingly opposite things at the same time. So what Red Boot does is, it's all about creating a mindset that when I'm ready to engage with someone who has a different mindset than mine, what can I do to create a space where something more than conquer and divide can happen? It's not going to fix everything, but it does change things.
The only reason I use that terminology mm-hmm. is because sometimes, and I know this because I've been a mediator, and I've got a friend who's a mediator who uses this in his openings, when people have the tendency to always want to be right, it shuts down their ability sometimes to listen. So I think part of your 11 steps here is being open and curious to other ideas, and part of which is being willing to listen.
Totally.
And maybe that's something that's not going on as well in Washington.
Oh, I didn't see any of it. It was about winning. You know, what can I do to win? And it's hard to win and be, you know, it's hard to win without somebody else losing. I know there's the concept of win-win, but that's not what I saw there.
And so these stories and the wisdom stories, how many do you have in the book?
I think there's like 80.
80?
I don't know
80.
Exactly.
Okay. So the idea is you read these stories and you reflect on them, and hopefully you'll come to some of your own ideas and ways to
either that, or I'll just completely mess with your with your mind, like the Gucci Juarez
right.
reference. I mean, it does. It just sort of unsettles. Okay, now what do I do about that?
All right, well, we're going to take one now that's a little bit different than the two that you've just read, and it involves your mother.
Yeah.
And this, I'll let you categorize it later after you read it. But why don't you read this piece? That has to do with you and your mother.
Sure. Being pretty. I remember when I realized my mom was pretty. She was 50 years old and 1 year sober. I was 11. The year was 1971, and the two of us were driving to New York City. Now, understand, we couldn't have made this trip any earlier. My mom's alcoholism had gotten so bad toward the end of it that she was usually drunk by the time I got home from school. So riding in the car with her had been, and I'm not being overly dramatic, a life or death situation. When my mom got sober, she got real. It wasn't overnight, but it was pretty damn quick. We laughed, we cried, we became like two old friends who hadn't seen each other for 11 years, making up for lost time. As usual, the traffic heading into New York City was heavy, and particularly slow at the entrance to the Holland Tunnel. Our LeSabre was beginning to overheat, and there was no easy place to pull the car over. So we just held our breath and hoped the car would make it through the tunnel. We got right to the entrance when that old car started smoking and clunking, and then, you guessed it, it died right there at the entrance to the Holland Tunnel. My mom didn't appear the least bit upset. "Oh well," she sighed as she put the car in park. "Wait here." And what happened next was something to this day I won't ever forget. My mother stuck her arm out the window, stopped the traffic, stepped out into the lane, came round the front, lifted the creaky hood, situated it so it stayed up, peeked her head around from underneath, cocked her hip to one side, and began waving and smiling like nobody's business. I think it took less than 4 seconds for the driver of a tractor trailer to stop his rig and holler out through the passenger side of his window, "Hello, miss, do you need some help?" "Yes, thank you very much, sir," she yelled over the traffic noise, which included plenty of beeping horns at that point. Now, mind you, I was observing all of this from the passenger side of that old LeSabre and taking note, albeit only through an 11-year-old's life experience, of the scenario playing out in front of me. I think after several minutes of checking out the engine, he poured some water into something under the hood. Mom cranked her up, and off we went through the tunnel. "Well, thank goodness for that," she said. I didn't know what that was, and I sure don't remember whether she took the car to the gas station or not, but I do remember the truck driver and my mom's cocked hip and pretty smile. Pretty has a lot of power, and even now at age 57, at times I struggle to figure out when to cock my hip and when not to.
Okay, I assume you had fun writing this.
I did. The stories about my mother and my kids are just funny to me.
You describe in here a happy time.
Yeah.
And I assume that there were times that were not nearly as happy as this.
No, I had the benefit, unlike my siblings, of watching my mom get sober. So after she got sober, and I've shared this many times, it was like the blinds on the windows just shot to the top of the windowsill. It was amazing.
Did that help you in your own struggle?
Oh, totally. So, you know, it's interesting. I got sober many years earlier than my mom got sober. So, yeah, absolutely.
And how are you doing with it?
Great.
Good.
25 years, actually. Yeah.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay, we got another piece here. We've gone from being pretty to being white.
Being white. Years ago, I was on a bike ride with a friend of mine, Jeff. He recounted a funny story back when he moved to North Carolina. A certified Northernite, he had moved to Charlotte, having lived his whole life in the Northeast. He threw baggage for U.S. Airways. As I recall, his story went something like this. When I moved here, everybody was so nice, but there was one thing I just couldn't figure out. Every time I assisted someone, they would follow up my helpful act with the words, "pretty shaded." I didn't know what that meant, and being new and just trying to fit in, I started saying it too. Someone would do something nice for me, like hold open a door, and I would automatically follow up their kind act with, "pretty shaded." Finally, after half a year or so, one of the guys stopped me and said, "Jeff, what are you saying? What the hell does pretty shaded mean?" I laughed and said, "I don't know. I was just saying what you did. Everyone here says pretty shaded." After sifting through the howls and winds of the strange words, the two of us figured it out. The words I had heard as pretty shaded were appreciated, with a southern accent. Something akin to this happened to me a while back, and it's good stuff. I was speaking to a group of local leaders about my cross-country trip in 2014. For that trip, which lasted the full month of August, I rented a Mustang convertible, donned a pair of red cowboy boots, and headed west and back to go deep into this question: why is America so polarized? After having served 2 years on a commission in our nation's capital tasked with fixing the uncivil dialogue happening on the Hill, I was still highly frustrated by what seemed to be an us versus them happening in all facets of American life. So what better way to get to the bottom of it than going to the American people and asking us, "What do you think is going on with all the polarizing dialogue?" After I shared the story of my trip and the many encounters I had experienced with literally hundreds of people from all facets of American life, I asked folks in the audience, "Does anyone have any first impressions, thoughts, takeaways from what I've just shared?" As I recall, someone said, "Inspirational." I think someone else might have said, "Courageous." After a pause, a young African-American man who was sitting front and center raised his hand. I nodded to him. "Yes?" "White privilege," he said. Like a knife to my gut, I felt myself react. It felt like my insides died a little bit. I felt diminished, small, scared even. The discomfort in the room was palpable. Pins and needles, awkward, scary. "That hurt," I said out loud. "I don't know why, but that hurt." "I don't mean to hurt you, but you asked my first impression, and my first impression is white privilege." We sat there looking at each other for what felt like an eternity. My guess is, though, it was probably only a dozen or so seconds. And then I asked, "Why does this hurt so much?" Another pause, and I said, "I think it's this hurt that stops people from talking to each other." His gaze was strong, clear, and very honest. As I recall, he tried explaining a little bit about what he meant by white privilege, but the truth is, I was dealing with where to go from there. It was like being caught naked in front of a room full of people. What do I do? Where do we go? How do I move forward? I'm so embarrassed, ashamed, unsure of myself. "Will you go to lunch with me?" I asked. "I need to understand why this hurts, what's going on here." I motioned toward my heart. "I think what's going on in here is what's going on everywhere." After my presentation, he handed me his card. A couple of weeks later, Patrick and I went to lunch. We talked for an hour or more about our lives, as in really talked, not about what we do, but what we feel, see, believe, what matters to us. Somewhere at the beginning of all that, I asked him point blank, "What do you mean by white privilege? I don't really understand what those words mean. I just know that I had a gut-wrenching, knee-jerk reaction to them. "Imagine if someone like me," he said, "tried to do what you did last summer. How many people would have talked so openly to me? Molly, you are the most non-threatening person, both in spirit, but also in form. My experience on a trip such as yours would have been different, even if my intention had been the same, simply because of how I show up in the world." After some more dialogue on the topic, I said, "I get it now. I'm a small, white, blonde, 50-something female. Who's going to be afraid of me? Pretty shaded. Appreciate it. White privilege." I had been afraid of the words, had disdain for them, actually, because I hadn't understood them. Patrick has become one of my best friends. We meet regularly for lunch. We talk from the deep places that scare us, inspire us, mean something. We met this past week for lunch, as a matter of fact, and as I write about him now, I can feel myself well up. "Keep doing what you're doing," he says. "You can reach people I can't." I love this man. I love the fact that he lets me be me fully. When I'm with Patrick, I feel safe to be myself, and just plain safe. And I wonder if that's what we all want anyway. I pretty shade this man.
Not sure where to start. That's a, and I can see that it has an emotional effect on you. Your eyes are watering a little bit.
Yes.
So you're standing there, you're talking about this journey, you feel good about some of the things you've accomplished, you've spoken to people, you've gotten them to open up, and you're reaching out for feedback, and wham, somebody hits you with, I mean, they might as well have called you a racist, and you're stuck. And you say to yourself, maybe this is why people don't talk to each other. They get that hurt feeling inside. How did you compose yourself enough to get beyond that particular moment to try to understand where this person was coming from?
It was amazing. I will bet that everyone that was there remembers it well also. I just knew that this is, I just decided not to stay in the fear in that moment and really look at why am I afraid to speak about this, right? Where did that fear come from? It's just two human beings trying to understand each other. And it's fascinating how deeply fearful I was. Since then, I've been able to speak on all sorts of things because I realize that that fear is contrived. It's created to keep us from talking about it. You know, if we don't talk about this stuff, then everything will stay as it is.
And that is one of the hardest things for people like you and me, white Americans who grow up. We didn't grow up across the border in Juarez, Mexico. We grew up in families that nurtured us, cared for us. We've got jobs, and we think we're being responsible, taking responsibility for ourselves, and yet it's hard to put yourself in other people's shoes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this concept of empathy comes from. Empathy is a part of your Red Boot way as well, correct?
Totally.
And there is a difference between empathy and sympathy, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Sympathy, we're talking about, you know, compassion or sorrow or pity, that's a different idea. Empathy is actually trying to feel what the other person's feeling or putting yourself in their position, which is not easy to do, right?
Yeah, and I would say that empathy is, I'll never be able to put myself, you know, in the shoes of someone else.
You can try.
I can try to understand, which is a little bit different. And then the other thing that I've learned about compassion and sympathy, I even would pick those two things out, although the definitions may not be picked out in the dictionary. Compassion to me is a shared suffering. So I am aware that I am also human and in a place, I know what suffering feels like, so I will hold this space and allow you to be where you are. It's the shared suffering. And sympathy is to have pity for, which to me is not helpful at all.
Right.
Yeah.
I've heard it described another way. Sympathy is, you know, I feel sorry for you. Empathy is, I am you.
Yes. You know? Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so, but it's very hard to get to understand that. And in this particular piece, it took for you sitting down and having a conversation with a person and trying to understand their perspective. And it was understandable, right?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the hardest things that I had to come to grips with is I had created a picture of myself as this highly charismatic, friendly, outgoing, like just anybody would want to talk to me because of how wonderful my spirit is. And I had to tune that down a notch, because the fact is all these other factors play into why people want to talk to me too. It's both. I mean, I am a friendly, outgoing person, and I'm a non-threatening white middle-aged female.
But you're a non-threatening white middle-aged female that's doing great work.
Exactly. Like, so to hold both. I mean, and that's another thing is, you know, and I'll just, you know, white folk who dim their light to, out of shame, serves no one. There's another friend of mine named Toussaint Romain who said to me, you know, that shame is not serving you. Don't do that anymore. Stop it. You be you, is what he said. And I've never forgotten that either.
Okay, the book, The Wisdom mm-hmm. Stories, where can we find it?
It's really simple. It's just mollybarker.com. And there's a whole page dedicated to it there, and folks can order it.
And it's also in bookstores as well?
It's in Park Road Books. That's it.
Okay, yeah. And it's online, correct?
Online, yeah.
Great. And you're thinking about doing an audio version?
Working on an audio version in a few weeks, okay. Which will be at the website as well.
Great. Well, Molly, I want to thank you for joining me today. This has been a fun day. I've enjoyed your readings. They're very, whether you meant for them to be topical, there's some very topical stuff in here, and it gives you something to think about. So well done.
Thank you.
So that's it for today. Another author giving voice to their written words. Thank you for listening to Charlotte Readers Podcast. If you liked our show, please tell your friends. And if you really liked it, you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and by subscribing to the show wherever you listen to it, which you can do for free. Please remember our Season 1 sponsor, Park Road Books. They're right there in Park Road Shopping Center. Drop by the store. You'll be glad you did. And don't forget to check out charlottereaderspodcast.com and the free ebook you can get by signing up for our email list. Speaking of email, my email address is on the website, and I'd love to hear from you. Tell me what you like about the show. Tell me what you'd like to see different. And if you have the name of a Charlotte area author you'd like to hear from, give me the name and I'll follow up. You can like us on Facebook and tweet at us on Twitter. We're going to try to put these shows out on a weekly basis. And next week, we have another talented author coming to read their work. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.